My name is Mary Morris, and my book is The Red House, and thank you for having me, Beth.
In her new novel, The Red House, author Mary Morris creates a fictional history behind the actual Red House, a World War II concentration camp she discovered during her travels in southern Italy. Her literary mystery follows 42-year-old Laura on a journey to uncover what led to her mother's disappearance back when Laura was just 12 years old. I recently spoke with Mary Morris about her travels that led to the book and this little-known history from World War II. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Mary Morris. So although this new book, The Red House, is literary fiction, it's also a mystery of sorts. And since we're careful not to reveal spoilers, I wonder if you could give our listeners a brief description of the book.
Sure. Laura is a 42-year-old woman. Her mother disappeared when she was 12 years old. And Laura and her family never really recovered from it. They never found her mother. And Laura is now the same age as her mother was when she disappeared. And she realized that she's stuck in her life. And she decides that despite not wanting to think about this for a very long time, she needs to find her mother's story. And Laura was raised partially in Italy. And she goes to Italy in search of her mother's story, really. And that's all I'll say about the plot.
I've also seen The Red House described as true crime. You include a disclaimer at the beginning of the book that explains that this is fiction, but that The Red House is a real place and that you have not taken liberties behind the truth. Can you tell our listeners a bit of the truth or fact behind The Red House?
Absolutely, because it was really a very dramatic story for me. So my husband, we do house swaps. We swap our house for other people's, and we go and live in strangers' houses and vice versa. And it's worked for many, many years. And in 2015, we went to southern Italy on a swap. And the people in the family who lived nearby, we had their farmhouse, they lived nearby. They insisted on taking us to this very touristy town. And I have a partial life as a travel writer, and I really avoid, I've never been to the Eiffel Tower, or I've never been to any monuments. I mean, I did not want to go to a tourist town. So I reluctantly went, and then I claimed exhaustion, and I bought an ice cream cone, and I went off, and I sat in a churchyard by myself. And there was a tree in the churchyard, and on the tree, there was a plaque. And after a while, I got up, and I went, and I looked at the plaque. And it's a very tacky town. It's all t-shirts, and it's just lots of tour buses, you know. But in this churchyard, on this tree, was this plaque, and it was written in two languages that I actually can read. One was Italian, and the other was Hebrew. And it said, in both languages, from the people of Jerusalem to the people of Arbelobello, which was the name of the town, for your kindness during the Nazi era, racist era, they called it. And I thought, what does this strange town have to do with the Nazi era? Like, it's way in the south of Italy. And so I started asking around. I went to the tourist bureau. I asked my friends. I didn't know where or why the town mattered in Jewish history. For a long time, I've been attached to Jewish history or just history. I'm interested in buried histories, like people who find out, you know, that they're 1/16th African-American. I'm reading something now where that's a plot point, you know, where you don't know your whole story. So I'm interested in those kinds of narratives. And anyway, long story short, it took a while, but through various ways, I managed to find out that there was a place called the Red House, and it had been a detention center. And 3 years later, just before COVID started, we actually went back to the same part of Italy, and I found the Red House. It looks like what it is, which is a concentration camp. And it's 5 miles outside of the town, and it was padlocked. And I just had this sinking feeling that I did not want to write a book. I didn't want to do it. I'm not going to do it. But I couldn't really walk away from it, you know. And I managed to find the guy that had the keys to this building. They were going to turn it into a discotheque. It was about to be renovated. When the guy who had the keys actually worked in cultural affairs, and he found out the history of this place and said, you cannot turn this into a discotheque. So it was sitting there, and he unlocked it for me. And I was able to walk in. And I, as I say in some of my other essays and introductions, I felt that once I walked in, I couldn't really walk out until I wrote about it. So that kind of became the story. And then the woman and the mother and the mystery all kind of comes together in its own way.
So the chapters in this book alternate between past and present through a chorus of voices and perspectives. Primarily, we learn through memory, but there's also an omniscient perspective involved. When Laura meets Tommaso, at first she questions his memory.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to me about the unreliability of memory? Because this didn't seem like an unreliable narrator to me, but I'm wondering if that's a tool as a writer that you rely on.
She is doubting because she can't quite believe that he knows and remembers her history. But then his story does pick up. His story, and then there's another person who's a relative whose story picks up. You know, the book is called, I think it's written in, it's The Red House, and I think it's written in four stories. I was playing with the different stories. So the first story, so to speak, is really Laura's, and then the second is more Tommaso's, and then it goes to the other person, and then we come back to Laura. But it's a structure that I wanted. I mean, to me, Tommaso is reliable in that he's telling, and it's more that Laura has to come to terms with what her real story is, because she knows nothing about it. She knew nothing. So I've said elsewhere, you know, that she's looking for her mother and she finds herself, which is a little bit of a cliche, but actually it's the truth. So.
Are you ever drawn to some characters more than others? Like, was there one in the Red House that captured your imagination more than others?
Well, I really liked Laura and her job. I mean, I really had a lot of fun with the fact that she stages real estate. You know, I could have even done more with it, I think, but I took it as far as I wanted to. But I was drawn to her. I was drawn to the detective who was on the mother's case for so long, Detective Hendricks. And I really had a deep affection for Tommaso because he had loved and lost and was very bittersweet about his life. You know, it's true. I mean, sometimes you're just drawn, just like with people, you know, sometimes you're really happy when they show up and sometimes you go like, oh God, I got to get through this dinner, you know? But I felt, you know, I get intrigued by people and their lives and kind of strange quirks. I like quirkiness when I can find it.
I think I even highlighted in my copy that when Laura's describing going to flea markets to find photos that she will use to stage homes, I kind of loved that she creates histories for the homes that don't exactly exist.
Right. Like she gave people happy houses where they didn't. And of course, she knows how to do that because that was part of her childhood, you know, staging as a child. You know, they wanted to get out of the house that their mother disappeared from. And so she learned how to create the semblance of happiness where there wasn't any. And of course, that became her life.
There were a couple of themes in the book that I want to ask about. The first is birds. Not only is Viola nicknamed Pigeon, but she also watches them from her window. Joseph's mm-hmm. father kept homing pigeons. The captain kept songbirds. And while I don't recall Angelo painting birds, he did paint images of flight. Do you want to talk about that theme at all?
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, until you just said it, I hadn't really thought of it. I mean, birds are very important to me. They're slightly more important to my husband. So we live in New York City, right? Which everybody thinks, whatever. But we're in Brooklyn. And since we've been in our house, we bought a house a long time ago. It was the only really truly smart thing we did investing, but we bought a house. We have like four or five big trees around our house. And we bought the house in part because there was a beautiful oak tree in back. I come from Illinois. My husband's from Ontario. We're not New Yorkers. So maybe we need a little context there, you know, like we planted a maple tree in front of the house. You know, we both grew up with maple trees. And the boy where we bought the house from, he'd left a Christmas tree in the backyard. And we stuck it in the ground and now it could go to Rockefeller Center. I mean, it's just kind of crazy. So we're surrounded by trees, which means we're surrounded by birds. So there's a lot of birds and we see them coming and going. And so, you know, I'm very interested in them. I have a parrot. I kind of live in a pirate ship, but I have a parrot and she's very talkative and I'm very attached to her and I've had her for 28 years. So birds are in my life in different ways. I respect them. I respect their intelligence and I love their freedom. I used to have, and sometimes I still have, flying dreams where I'm flying, you know, over landscapes and the earth. And all the dreams, I had navigational redial in my belly button. And if I pushed it, I could go home. So I didn't have to worry about getting lost, which anyway. So the flight has always been an important thing for me. And I've always been somebody with sort of flights of fancy and just the idea of flight. I like freedom.
I read your epigraph, and one of the quotes is from Dumas' The Count of Monte Cristo.
Mm-hmm.
All of human wisdom is contained in these two words, wait and hope, which mm-hmm. later makes a lot of sense when the book begins to play a role in the novel. Can you talk to me about this choice?
So I was making the list of library books that the detainees would have had in the Red House. And there is actually in the Red House a list of the library books that people checked out. I have a copy of that list. You know, I have the graphic of it. And it would be like Quo Vadis and, you know, Don Quixote, and The Count of Monte Cristo was one of the books on the list. So I looked at some of the books to see if anything resonated for me in any of them. And I got a library copy of The Count of Monte Cristo. I didn't realize it was 1,200 pages long. You know, I think I read the kids' version, you know, a long time ago. But when I got to the wait and hope, and I thought to myself, you know, that I wanted Laura's grandfather to check out a library book that he doesn't return. And I thought that the idea of that book, of course, it's a great novel of escape. You know, there's been a lot of talk lately about Alcatraz and rebuilding Alcatraz, which is a whole other conversation. But anyway, you know, that whole world of prisons and, you know, the rock, you know, prisons that are rocks. And, you know, the Count of Monte Cristo was at this island prison right off of Marseille, you know, and then he jumped off and all these improbable things happened in his life. So I was really fascinated with that. Anyway, that's how the quote came to, and I found the quote in the book. And when I read the quote, I realized I didn't have to read the 1200 page book because I found the quote that I wanted, which is how I do research. Anyway, you know, you try to find that thing that, you know, like when I worked on a previous book, I read a lot about Al Capone because he was a big character in the book. But when I read that Al Capone was a great dancer, that's all I needed to know about Al Capone. Sometimes you do that, you do all the research and then you just find that one little thing. So anyway, that's kind of how it worked for that. Yeah.
And there's probably nothing here, but I kept noticing the mention of leftovers. Laura remembers of her mother that she never bought more than she needed. And in a chapter from Sophia's perspective, we learn that leftovers made her sad.
Well, in the Italian case, they would make her sad because she was used to feeding her big family, right? I remember reading Jim Polihiri's wonderful collection of short stories, The Interpretive Maladies, where there was a woman who watched a little boy. She had come to America and she had nothing to do and she was a babysitter. And she cut too many onions every day as if she were feeding, you know, a big family. But her husband would say to her, why are you cutting all these onions? You know, because... So anyway, you know, I've always thought about that people who are alone, sometimes they don't know that they're not cooking for 8 or 10 people. They're just, you know, cooking for each other or whatever, or yourself. So that kind of has a poignancy for me with Sophia. You know, in terms of Viola and her family, if you're starving, I mean, my husband doesn't let me throw anything out, not because he was starving, but because, you know, his family just, they never threw anything out. You know, you ate everything. So I think they're very, very different uses of leftovers, but I hate leftovers personally. So, you know, only if I absolutely have to. So we try to eat everything. It was better. It helped when we had a dog, I have to say. The dog is gone. I don't know what to do with like egg yolks and things like that. But hunger, I think, to be serious again, hunger and starvation are really an important part of the book. And also when the book goes to Naples, you know, I mean, people really, really were starving. And, you know, we see, you know, lots of images now that we don't really want to see on the news of people really, really hungry. And, you know, that's what it was like for these people. You know, it wasn't just the people in the Red House. It was all of Italy was starving. You know, the people in Naples would eat snails and dandelion greens. And these are Italians, you know, they want to eat. Or they would, you know, 60% of the women in Naples were prostitutes during the war, just to feed their families. So hunger is something real, and leftovers are a luxury, I suppose.
I know this is fiction, but I couldn't help but notice that some of your personal interests are included, if only peripherally. So I'm thinking of painting, and although Laura was doing this with a purpose, travel. Talk to me about writing about art and artists, and also in doing research for this novel, was there a trip to Italy involved with this creation?
Oh, please. I'm not stupid. No, yes, there were several trips to Italy, and I always felt I could justify them. So that was great. I actually learned to fall in love with Naples. I love Naples as a city. You know, I'm sorry it's getting all this bad press about the tremors, because I think it's an incredibly wonderful city. I am very interested in visual art, and I am moving, even though I think about it a lot, I mean, I write all the time, but I don't paint every day. I would like to, but I do paint a lot. And a lot of the stuff in my studio is my own work. And behind me are 75 journals that I've kept over many, many years. And many of them are not only, they started as being writing journals, but they're also visual journals now. And so I travel with a watercolor kit. I travel with glue. I travel with waterproof pens and waterproof journals that I use as writing for my writing. Everything begins in my journals, everything. So, you know, I have found that a journal that's about 6 by 4 inches is the best size for me to go traveling with. And I don't record anything systematically in my journals. So I basically would never be able to find anything, but I create an index on the front page of every journal. So I know that, for example, if I'm working on The Red House, it appears on page 5, 32, 85, and I'll index everything, and then I later put post-its in it. So all of the journals behind me all have post-its in it. I'm like a monk in a monastery, you know, in my process. It's hardly a very contemporary process, but it really works for me. And I, you know, I love it. You know, I love to work. And yeah, that's kind of how it is, but everything starts in the journals. And Laura is interested in painting. I mean, she did go to art school. I just published a Substack today called Don't Be Afraid, that is actually based on going to see a very, very excellent David Hockney show in Paris recently. And just thinking about like life as exuberation, life as celebration. As a friend said to me years ago, if you're an artist and your ego's involved, you're doomed for all eternity. Okay. So that's all you need to know. Just forget about it. So, you know, one of the things that when I'm writing, sometimes I'll get ego invested and forget that I'm actually creating my own art. And when I paint, I just really care about the flow. Like I've tried to take classes and I've tried to learn things, but I can't really learn anything. So I just do whatever happens naturally. And I find that that is, you know, I like to tell that to students too. Like, don't feel like you have to be linear, you know, let your mind go where it wants to go.
This happens to be the second novel I've read in the past few weeks in which an adult child is unraveling the mystery of what happened to one of their parents. And you know, I truly think the timing is a coincidence, but it makes me wonder, do you think that there's something about adulthood or middle age or something like that that compels one to think deeper about one's own parents?
Well, I think I've been thinking deeply about my own parents for my entire life. But I do think that once we get some distance and, you know, perhaps once our parents have passed, it is a lot easier to assess what we have been through, good and bad. Like, for example, I feel much closer to my mother. I find myself loving things that she loved, loving art that she loved, loving wearing her clothes that she left me that I didn't want to wear for a long time. You know, I find myself making peace in a way that I maybe wasn't able to so much. But I think we do. I mean, I think we go through stages of life where we are constantly reassessing that relationship to the past. I wrote a lot about my mother was desperate to travel as a girl, never did. And I grew up in a household of a woman who wanted to travel and a man who just wanted to play golf. And travel became very important to me. You know, my mother kind of kicked me out the door in a good way. You know, she said, you're going to go places, you're going to travel, you're going to go to college in the East, you're not going to stay in the Midwest. You know, at the time, those weren't necessarily what I wanted, but my life wouldn't be my life if she hadn't pushed me. So for that, I'm really grateful. I've always remained a little mad that she told me that yellow wasn't my color and I've never worn yellow, but that's a whole other matter. She had a degree in fashion. What can I say? She was good. But yeah, I think I think we are always processing our lives, no matter who we are. Everyone is processing their lives. And as we get older and looking back, I think there's a lot more understanding and there can be a lot more forgiveness. You know, it's nice if you can do it when people are still around, but however you need to do it, if you may need to forgive yourself, you know. Can I share something kind of hokey?
Yeah.
So we're watching this series, The Pit, which I actually really like, but he's an ER doctor. And he says something that I found really moving where there's a parent who's passing away. He said, I always tell people to say four things. Say, thank you. I love you. I forgive you for whatever you did to me. I apologize for whatever I did to you. And I thought that was really simple and really beautiful. And Plato said this, everyone's be kind. Everyone's going through something. But I've written a lot about maternal abandonment. I've written several books that involve maternal abandonment. I mean, it seems to be a theme I keep going back to. So I may not be done with it yet. Also, just from a writing point of view, I'm very interested in the disappeared, not in the political sense, but in people who vanish. I'm very interested in those stories because they're stories. So there is one thing about the origin of the Red House that I don't talk about that often, but I was in Memphis many years ago. I think I know when it was. It was probably, I don't know, 2009. I was in line waiting to get on the plane, you know, early-ish TSA stuff, waiting to get on. And something fell behind me and there was a button fell on the floor and I picked it up to, and I was going to hand it to the man who dropped it. And he said, oh no, you can keep that. And I looked at it and it was a woman's face. Of course, this is just coming back to me now. It was a woman's face and written around it was, have you seen this woman? And her name was Viola. And he said, that's my wife. And she disappeared. And I give these to everybody. And, you know, I'll never stop looking. And I've never forgotten that man. And I've kept that button. It's on my bulletin board. It's always been there. And I hadn't even really thought it through that Viola becomes Viola, you know, that I took the name. But that piece of the story came, you know, I'm publishing the story now in 2025. And that was from 2009, where I began to think about what would make a mother, you know, disappear. And I decided it would have to be something very, very powerful. And I think it is for Laura's mother.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
Yes, I do. I mean, one thing I will say is that I hope they love this story because I always love a good story. And the words I'm getting from readers is that the story is very compelling to them. So I hope that. And also, it's a very little known piece of World War II history. I didn't know anything about this. I literally stumbled on it. Italians I know don't know anything about it. You know, I think it's important that we keep knowing things and learning. You know, I know there's all kinds of controversy around the idea of the good Italians, you know, that they didn't really want to deport their Jews, that they, you know, they were really good Italians. And no, they were fascists, you know, and they followed Mussolini and they weren't so good, but they were better. They were better than others. And of all the Jews that were sent to the Red House, only 9 were deported. And I don't know for what reasons, but hundreds were not, in part because the town really, from what I understand, the town didn't know what Jews were. I mean, it's southern Italy, and it's, you know, it's a very tribal kind of world there. And I think they thought Jews would have tails and horns. But instead, and it's in the book, what happened was that the people who came to the Red House, if they were professionals, they worked in town. This was also true for Carlo Levi, who wrote Christ Stopped at Eboli. He was a painter, but he was also a doctor, and he did some doctor stuff. So people were like, why should we deport these people? I mean, they're just people. You know, but what happened in northern Italy is a completely different story. I mean, if you were Jewish and you were lucky, you were sent to the south. So, you know, overall, you know, the very, very vast percentage of Jews who were deported to the south survived. Many opted to stay in the south. Many opted to stay throughout the war. There were beaches. It was pleasant. Although you have to remember that when they arrived, there was nothing there. There was no infrastructure for them at all. There were no schools. There was nowhere to live in a lot of cases. I mean, the people who lived in the Red House lived there, but they had no blankets. They had no food, you know, so they had to really make everything happen for themselves. So I just think, you know, it's a piece of history also that's just not known to people. You know, we know about the North, we know about Mussolini. You know, we know about films like the Gardens of the Finzi Contini and things like that, where we know about, you know, very wealthy Italian Jews who thought, well, this is obviously never going to happen to me. Whereas the people in the South had a different story. So if you could call it lucky, you know, I suppose in a sense that they, well, more of a sense, they were lucky to have been sent there. So that's what I hope. I hope people enjoy reading it, and I hope that they learn something.
Well, the book is The Red House. Mary Morris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Mary Morris, author of the book The Red House, which was published by Doubleday. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.